Managing Violence Podcast, episode 75, with legendary martial arts author Lawrence Kane. We're going to be talking Sun Tzu, The Art of War, ancient wisdom for modern application, and so much more. Make sure you check it out. All right, everybody, welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast. As I mentioned, I'm going to be joined today by Lawrence Kane. Lawrence has written over 20 books, many of them about martial arts instruction, violence, advice for managing real-world violence. He's a tremendous author, and he's certainly his work has certainly made an impact on my life and my career, so it was a pleasure to sit down and talk with him at length. Lawrence was very generous with his time. He's a very busy guy, not only as a writer, but also in his professional career. But before I get to Lawrence, I am well overdue to thank a number of our Managing Violence Patreon contributors. You guys get a shout out when you join the tribe, and I am overdue to thank a number of people. So in no particular order, people that I don't believe I've thanked yet on air. If I have thanked you and you get a second one, that one's on the house, although feel free to double your contribution if you feel so inclined. So I do need to thank Sheridan Zhang, Ray Galea, Mary Stevens, obviously former guest Mary Stevens, also a Patreon contributor. How nice is Mary to be a guest and also to contribute? Been very, very fortunate to have a number of my guests as contributors, which is fantastic. Paul Harper, Donna Altena, and Barry D. Whoever you are, wherever you are, if you contribute to the podcast, I thank you so much for your support. You're the ones that pay for the hosting, you pay for the subscriptions, you pay for the software that goes into making this podcast happen. And without you, we wouldn't be doing it. So thank you very much. If you're interested in finding out what these guys get in return, other than just a shout out on the podcast, make sure you head on over to patreon.com/managingviolence. Have a look at the different tiers. Have a look at the different bonus content. Every single episode, there is bonus content. Today, the bonus content, I think, is around about half an hour. So an extra half an hour, an extra show, basically, just for as little as $5 a month. So if you're interested in that, head on over to patreon.com/managingviolence. Also, make sure you check out the links in the description if you would like to buy me a coffee/Joe MVP. Or if you'd like to pick up a copy of my book, Neon Jungle, now available on Amazon. That's it for the plugs. Let's get to the episode. Here is Mr. Lawrence Kane. Okay, joining me on the Managing Violence Podcast, I have legendary martial arts author Lawrence Kane. Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. I don't know about legend, but I do have 20 books out there, so I guess that gets along the ways.
Well, you're up there in terms of volume, and I think the quality is fairly universally accepted as being of a high level. But your name was a name that when I was a teenager, spending my time lurking in bookstores, trying to read as much as I could without having to pay for them. Your name was frequently in front of my eye level at the old Borders bookstore, for any Australians that remember Borders. But yeah, I spent a lot of time reading your books when they were on shelf back when that was a thing.
You know, a little inside story for anybody who's thought about doing a book or whatever. Back in the day, if you sold a book, you basically automatically sold about 3,500 copies, assuming it went through a big publisher, because they had to stock it in shelves. Hmm. Today, if you publish a book, you've automatically sold one copy, the author one that you get for yourself. It's a very different market. And you know, quality perseveres, and because there's so much garbage out there, there's like 4 million new titles every year. And so, you know, I and the folks that I co-write stuff with, we always try to give really high quality, really valuable stuff, so people come back and you know, ask for more and see me working.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I picked up Martial Arts Instruction, the book you wrote for instructors, very early when I first started teaching. I picked up that book and found it very useful. I've recommended the Little Black Book of Violence pretty much ever since I first read it, maybe 15 years ago. Scaling Force with Rory Miller is a classic as well, which is incredibly useful for anyone who's involved in violence management on an ongoing basis. There's a ton of books. I can't go through your entire bibliography or else we wouldn't actually talk about anything else. But as you said, the 20 books are there. I only just found out when I was researching you for this podcast that you've also written fiction as well, which I didn't realize.
Very little. Yeah. I actually, the funny thing is I really wanted to be a fiction author. In fact, I went to I was really into science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction, stuff like that in high school and college. And I went to workshops at these conventions and stuff, and Inner Writers of the Future contest, all kinds of things. And basically, I'm not very good at fiction. I didn't realize nonfiction was an option, so I kind of gave up. And then what happened is martial arts instruction, which is funny because a ton of people tell me that they love that book. That's the worst book I ever wrote. It's also what started everything else. And so what happened was, a year before my black belt test, Chris Wilder, who's a fairly famous dude, he's my instructor. And he says, okay, you know, you're going to test in a year and I want you to bring a thesis. So I'm like, oh, wow, a year thesis. Okay. So I went off and did a bunch of research and did what you do for a thesis, right? So I show up on test day and I hand him 140 pages. And he's like, what the hell is this? I'm like, it's the thesis you asked for, sensei. It's like, oh, no, man, I'm like a research paper. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm an idiot. Well, about a month later, when he finished reading, he's like, this is fantastic. Wow, this is great. You got to get this published. And I'm, you know, kind of like going, okay, how do I do that? And he goes, I don't know, go figure it out. So, you know, sensei says, and I went and did it. And what happened was, there was three major publishing houses that had published the books I used as references. I wrote a letter to all three. I had, I basically had two of them within a month and a half or so agree that they wanted to buy it. And I just went for the first one. So ended up with YMA. It's part of Rory and Lauren and several others get pulled into YMA as well. And I never intended to write a book, even though I always wanted to. That was really successful. About, I don't know, 6-8 months or whatever after it was published, the publisher, David, calls me up and goes, oh yeah, you know, this is doing pretty good. What's your next one going to be about? And I'm like, oh, next one? I didn't think there was going to be a first one. So what I managed to do is I managed to talk Chris into helping me write a book I wasn't really qualified for, which is The Way of Kata, which is, you know, a lot of folks who take traditional martial arts kind of understand what that is, but I'd say the vast majority don't. And so what we did is codified the rules of Kaizen, among other things, which is how you translate all that, you know, moving around solo training stuff of a kata that looks wonderful and nobody knows what it means into the actual fighting art that it represents. And, you know, in the traditional martial arts circles, that was a huge hit. Little Black Book of Violence was in the sort of, you know, reality-based world and kind of everyday folk. So that's really what got me started. And it was a total accident. And as it turns out, I'm actually pretty good at the whole nonfiction thing. The fiction, you know, it's gotten some good reviews, but didn't sell enough to be worth doing the sequel. I actually had multiple sequels like mapped out, and there's a sales number, and it didn't hit the sales number, so I didn't go there.
Very, very interesting. As I said, I hadn't heard of the fiction until I actually started digging through your bibliography a little bit. But look, there's a lot we could talk about with any one of those topics. We did want to talk about your most recent book, Shit Sun Tzu Said, which I love yeah. That title. I love that title. But
so crass commercial announcement.
Oh, there we go. There'll be a link in the show notes.
And by the way, notice the size of this thing. I mean, you could like beat somebody to death with this. I mean, it's freaking huge. I have read, the camera is not tracking very well. Okay. I have read Art of War in multiple iterations. I mean, I think the first time I read it was in high school, and I always liked Musashi's work because it was kind of personal, and it was something where, you know, you understand, here's how I can use this in real actual combat or whatever, right? Art of War was, to me, it was always written for kind of like a general or a CEO or whatever, and it never really connected. And Chris and I did Musashi's Dakota, which was it's just 21 lines. It's the last thing he ever wrote before he passed on. Is some kind of, you know, wisdom to leave to a student. And we did a multi author interpretation of that, which I thought was pretty fun. And it did extremely well. And so Chris is like, oh, we got to write about Art of War. And like, dude, do you realize how big that thing is? I was like, yeah, it's great. And then we started going through it. And like Sun Tzu would say the same thing in 15 different ways. And so it's like, well, okay, what do we do with this? And we kind of brainstormed a little bit and came with the idea, let's make it real. Let's make it modern. Let's make it something that's accessible to people so they can actually do something with it. And so we went through every single one of the, what is it? There's 13 chapters and I forget how many, roughly 40 some odd, you know, sections in each chapter, and went through every one of those and gave examples of it and historical or modern stories about it. And then some things that you can either do or not do to do well because of that principle or not. And it was amazing to me how something written, you know, a couple thousand years ago is still so relevant. And I always learn a lot when I write stuff, and I try to put that into, you know, the audience, what I've learned as part of doing it. And I think that it's, I mean, it's by far the largest interpretation of Sun Tzu's work ever done. And I think it's the best, without trying to be, you know, bragging about it, because we actually show how to use it for things like self-defense, for business, for, you know, a variety of different situations, so that it's relevant. We didn't go with one theme. We kind of took it wherever it happened to fit, and some of it's business stuff and some of it's, you know, self-defense stuff and other things. But it gets down to that guy was freaking brilliant. And I mean, you know, although some people wonder if he's a real person or amalgamation of many, but be that as it may, stuff that was written all that long ago still applies and it's still useful. And I was actually kind of blown away by how insightful some of it is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what you've said there about making it practical, my observation from The Art of War and even the Book of Five Rings, and to some extent, even I was just chatting earlier today with Willie Johnson from Maryland about Bruce Lee, and we're talking about the Tao of Jeet Kune Do and how, you know, I first read that book when I was maybe 10, and then I read it again as a teenager, and I read it again in my 20s and in my 30s. And every time I sort of got a deeper level of meaning out of it because I could relate to more things. And I think the Book of Five Rings, with The Art of War, because as you said, it was written for the general class, it was written for politicians and rulers, that there was a certain level of experience that was, I guess, expected as a prerequisite for reading the book. So it was very easy to apply those principles. But if you're reading without experience, it can be hard to sort of see how it applies. And I think by giving those practical examples of everyday life or the situations that people can at least envision, that it does make the wisdom more accessible rather than just a nice concept.
Yeah, and that was the goal. I mean, everything I write, I try to make it useful. I mean, you know, I started off writing a book about how to teach, right? So there's a bit of teacher in me. I did martial arts for close to 50 years, right? So in fact, if I stuck with any one of them, I'd actually be pretty good at it. But but I've got a pretty broad experience, and I try to take that those disparate things I've done and pull it together in a way that's really accessible for people. And so, you know, I've got a corporate job. I negotiate multi-billion-dollar contracts for a living. I've also worked security. I've also taught martial arts. I've also done, you know, just a variety. Idea of things. I'm taught in a technical college for a while. And, you know, it's important to be able to connect with and use something. And so I've really tried with every book I've done to have a theme and then take that theme and make it real for the people who read it. And the funny thing is one of the worst and I think funniest reviews I ever got was on the Little Black Book of Violence. Somebody complained it was too long. It's like, the title's a pun, like, you know, but hey, if that's the worst complaint, is this too long? I really can't come, you know, I can handle that.
Look, I think I can top that. When I did my podcast with Jeff Thompson, the first interview I did with Jeff Thompson, end of last year, Jeff was obviously, he was an idol of mine. He was the person who inspired me to write a book. Jeff is just a tremendous human being. And I over-prepared for this podcast because at that time, Jeff had barely done any media for like 10 years. He's everywhere now. So he's kind of taken a bit of the bloom off the rose. But at the time, I felt very special that he was choosing to do my show. And I over-prepared. I read his most recent books. I had like four full A4 pages of notes, of questions I was going to ask him just to make sure it was as good as it could possibly be. And I didn't waste the opportunity. I got through maybe three questions and I had to fight for the third one to get it in because once I got Jeff rolling, it was just it was the Jeff Thompson show, and that's exactly what I wanted. But one of the reviews, because I shared the podcast everywhere, one of the reviews was too much talking. It's a podcast. It's a
podcast.
I'm like, okay. I'm not sure a podcast with no talking, but it's not much fun to listen to.
That's funny. Jeff's a great dude. Him and Ian, a lot of the British Combat Association folks, Peter Constantine, some really cool people on the other side of the pond there.
Yeah. Too much talking, though, unfortunately. Yeah. Anyway, so I can relate. A book with too many words, a podcast with too much talking. That's fun.
What else do you want in a podcast?
You know what? There's a I go on a tangent, but we'll leave that. So, so talking about this Sun Tzu concept and how you went about sort of, I guess, choosing the examples, and let's stay focused on the violence management ones for the sake of the title of this podcast and the listenership of this podcast, and applying some of those, I guess, macro warfare concepts of international relations, essentially, is what he was talking about. Posturing between different groups and posturing in different nation states and warring factions and insurrections and all these things that were topical thousands of years ago for a military general. And how do we apply those to the situations that a regular person may find themselves in now?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, he breaks it down into a bunch of different stuff, like, you know, plans and waging war and strategy and tactics and, you know, weak and strong points, maneuvering your troops, all kinds of stuff, right? And when you first look at it, you look at that and go, well, this isn't relevant, right? This is about, like you said, nation states. But think about it this way. Let's pretend you're walking home, you know, you take public transportation, take a bus or whatever, Uber or something. And there's a person on the bus or the Uber driver is acting in a strange way. And you think this is something bad's going to happen here, right? Would you rather be in your home neighborhood where you know people or in some place you don't know? And he talks to that. He talks to actually using the locals and gathering intelligence and using it to do, to implement your plans. And so you think about stuff like, you know, the common example of getting chased, right? When I was a kid, I would take a bus and go to judo. And while I'm wearing a judo gi, well, guess what? If you wear a judo gi on a public bus, as it turns out, sometimes people want to pick on you. And so I got in a few fights, and usually it was not many people. In one instance, it was like 7 or 8 guys, and they chased me, and it was pretty scary, yeah, because they were all bigger than me and they were faster than me, and I didn't know what to do. So, but I did know that when you go and run across a busy street, if you're first, you're probably not going to get hit, but the people chasing you might. I was like 7 or 8 at the time or something. And so there's this busy street that was out near it was at the Boys and Girls Club in Bellevue, for anybody who studied under Sensei Yamada there, or at the West, or at the, excuse me, the Saddle Dojo. So for location's sake. And so, you know, these guys chased me over several streets and went up over fences and the things I thought would get me away, and it didn't, because they're bigger and had longer stride. So I come up on Bellevue Way, which is the main street. So I think it was 4 lanes at the time, and I see a car coming, wait till it's just about there, and I bolt out in front of the car and timed it just perfectly, so the car slams on the brakes, kind of starts to slide as the other guys come right up against and kind of stop against the side of the car. The driver and the guys chasing me get a screaming match, and I disappear. And I'm like, ooh, tactics, you know, I am ninja. But the funny thing is I'm reading some of the stuff that Sun Tzu's talking about, you know, knowing the area, knowing how people are going to react, right? That's all part of it. A lot of interpersonal things that you can find in his writing when you start to look at it at the right level, right? And you know, things like... terrain. Specifically, he talks about how, you know, different types of terrain and what you do, and it's very timeless, you know, and it's a very it's an interesting thing because you have to draw the conclusion that I'm not talking about, you know, thousands of people in armies and horses and stuff. I'm talking about what are the dynamics of violence that take place at a sort of macro level and a micro level. The micro level really hasn't changed, right? The weapons are different, but the underpinning psychology and physiology of the people involved in the combat really aren't. And so, you know, there's a lot in there that directly applies. And it's pretty cool when you start to see that things really haven't changed largely in a couple thousand years, and it's still relevant.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and I think the reason that Sun Tzu's work, and it's not just Sun Tzu, I mean, there's a number of authors throughout history that have maintained that relevancy, as you said, are timeless. And I think the ones that are timeless are the ones that had an innate understanding of human nature. It wasn't about how do you use a spear? It was about the person holding the spear. And it was right. About the person commanding the people holding the spear. And when you understand human nature, that is universal. That's not changed. I mean, different pressures have the intensity dialed up and down depending upon time and history and location, all that kind of thing. But the general principles are the same. And I think one of the things that I've actually just been rereading it myself the last 12 months because I'm using sections of another book I'm writing on verbal de-escalation. But much the same, I was actually a little bit dismayed when I saw your book come out. I thought you might have stolen all my thunder. But some of the things that I drew out of there is everything from the psychology of the conflict in itself down to the actual maneuvering. Like we talk about it in martial arts about not being in the power box or not being directly in front of the person. And yet on the battlefield, we talk about flanking. We talk about maneuvering. We talk about multi-front wars. We talk about these things that are basically the same as we can apply in a one-on-one fist fight versus a nation state clash. It's amazing how universal these
things are. It really is. And think about an obscure one, right? So Attack by Fire is one of his chapters near the end of the book. And that's really, you know, the weapon of mass destruction of the time, right? Their nukes were firebombs. Mm. And fire is pretty hard to control. But the way people react to fire is very well known. And so they would do, there was different strategies that he used depending on where the wind was and the direction of, if people were in a town or in a forest or whatever. And, you know, talking about what do we do with fire to make people do something predictable so that we can then win, right? And if you think if you can take something as uncontrollable as fire and build a strategy around it based on that human psychology and sociology, well, you know, what can't you use strategically, right? Because there's very much a dynamic of the way people do things that's predictable. And so, you know, think about it in terms of counter ambush, for example. There's a bunch of stuff about ambush and counter ambush in the energy chapter. And so, you know, if I'm walking down the street and I see, you know, four or five people kind of strung out with some distance between them, just kind of hanging out on the side of the road, if I judge their body language, I might realize, oh wow, if I continue walking, the couple guys on the back are going to swing around behind me, the guys in the front are going to stop me, and then there's the guy on the side and I'm now surrounded because I've just walked into an ambush, right? So what do I do about that? Well, usually what I'm going to do is turn around and start walking the other direction. Well, then what if they chase me? Well, they were going to anyway, but at least now I'm in a better situation because they're all behind me. What if I insult them because they're actually hanging out, minding their own business, doing nothing, and it just looks suspicious? Well, okay, I'm an idiot, but you know what? I'm a safe idiot and I'm a live idiot, you know? And it's amazing how many people see something coming because they really know, you know, your gut, you know, this like gift of fear and, you know, people have written about this, right? Your gut tells you. It's amazing how many people know it's coming and walk into it anyway because they want to be polite to some stranger they've never met and who couldn't care less about them except as a resource.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we've had so many chats about that, about the curse of a polite society in a way. I mean, on one hand, don't be rude because you'll end up in violence you don't need to be in. But on the other hand, like if everything in you is saying this is a bad idea, it's probably a bad idea. And really it doesn't matter. They're probably not going to even notice the slight of you walking away anyway. Like if they weren't looking at you as a victim, they're probably not going to even notice that you turned and walked away from them. So,
it is amazing how unobservant people generally are when they're not actually pinging on you for some reason. I'll give you an example. It's a work story. So way back in ancient history, I worked in kind of the old Theory X times, right? So we go to these meetings and the head guys in the middle, this is big long table, head guys in the middle of the table flanked almost in rank order by his, you know, managers, senior managers and whatnot. And then our folks on the same side, and then us peons were along the in chairs along the wall. So my boss is presenting to this guy. He's a factory superintendent. They called him Pee-wee because he was like 6'8" and like, you know, 280 and used to be a D1 football player, right? Big dude, very red hair, light skin. And when he got mad, his whole face turned red. So I get this invitation to go with my boss to, you know, to go do this presentation. And this is back in the days when there was a secretary, there weren't administrative assistants back then, there were secretaries who would flip the view foils on the overhead projector, right? This is a long time ago.
Yep, I remember.
So anyway, so Pee-wee's, you know, directly across my boss in front of me, his name is Don, and I'm sitting next to Cheryl, who's one of my coworkers. And Pee-wee's not liking what Don's saying, and he gets mad. And he starts turning red in the face. And he starts yelling and dropping F-bombs and stuff, which would get you fired today in like 3 seconds. But back then it was normal. Yep. Takes his shoe off and starts pounding on the table. And Don is just sitting there just talking, right? Well, Pee-wee then chucks the shoe at him. And Don just kind of just leans a little out of the way. Shoe goes flying past him and it just barely touches my ear. Didn't really hit me, but I could just feel it because it hit the wall right next to me, right? I'm one of those people that my, you know, kind of fight, flight, freeze is fight. And, you know, I'm descended from a bunch of Vikings who tried to invade Constantinople, lost and settled in the steppes of Russia. There's probably a little berserker in there. I have lost it on occasion in, you know, conflict situations. Well, I don't remember standing up. I just remember thinking this guy just attacked me and I'm going to go across the table and kill him. And I start to go forward. And the only reason I realized I stood up is Cheryl's got a death grip on my leg and she's holding me back. And I suddenly realized nobody's reacted to this. This guy just was yelling and screaming and threw a shoe and nobody even noticed but me. And I realized like, oh, this is like normal, I guess. And so I just sat back down. If Cheryl hadn't been there, I would have been fired. I'd probably end up in jail or Pee-wee would have beat the crap out of me, one or the other, because he was a lot bigger than me. but, you know, my reaction was completely inappropriate for the situation because I'd never experienced it before. It completely caught me by surprise. And I just, you know, that hit that switch, right? But the fact is nobody else in the room even realized it. I mean, if they saw me stand up, they probably thought I was stretching or something.
Yeah.
And because afterwards, you know, Don's walking, I was behind him, so we never saw my reaction at all, but we're walking, he's going, oh, that was such a great meeting. And you get good FaceTime with the boss and, you know, and you're going to have to come back next month. And I'm thinking the whole time, like, no, this is like, this is bad. Because, you know, for him, he was used to getting shoes thrown at him, apparently. For me, that was a pretty wild situation, right? And so, you know, that context matters, and you know, your reaction is tempered by it. And, you know, I'm sure you say the OODA loop and things like that, right? Observe Orient. I never got through the Orient because it was too foreign. And that's one of the really cool things about training and also about reading things like, you know, Sun Tzu's work and others, where you can start to understand context you've never experienced, right? If you read Rory's stuff, you read, you know, Sun Tzu, you read Musashi, you read Lawrence stuff, or I mean, ton of folks, you know, Thompson or I mean, any of these guys, right? Peyton Quinn is another one, right? You start to hear about situations you may have never experienced. And it's better than nothing, right? I mean, training experience obviously is important, but just understanding this is a thing and this is what it means makes a huge difference. And so you don't, you know, go try to kill your boss's boss in the middle of a business meeting because you didn't understand what's going on, right?
Yeah, I think that it gives you that a bit of a boost for the orient phase of the OODA loop, because you can see something and go, that connects back to what I read about this, and this is what this might mean. Or once you've got that little bit of framework to compare it to it, and you know, what you said there about the others not reacting, I was thinking about something that I can't recall if Rory wrote about it or if it was something we said in a conversation with each other, but about how as you get experienced working around violence, you don't panic about it. Like you get to see what's normal acting out, what's not going to eventuate in any sort of harm, and what is going to eventuate in harm, and you act accordingly because the experience allows you to sift through that process. I mean, the people in that room have obviously seen that shoe fly quite a number of times, and they realize it's not going to go anywhere. But for you, that was a brand new experience, and the orientation kind of got skipped into berserker rage.
Yeah, and by the way, Cheryl, if you're watching, thank you. I do like working there. But you know, it's an interesting thing because he's absolutely right. I mean, if you get in his instance, he doesn't really get an adrenal rush at all anymore. But a lot of folks are that way in selectively. And somebody was telling me, I think it was Rory, but I may be misremembering, getting punched and getting stabbed. No reaction, getting shot at reaction, because that only happened one or two times. And so even though it's same level of violence as, you know, being shot, being stabbed, I've had been both. They're not fun. I don't recommend it. But they're different. And so your ability to handle it correctly sort of starts over again at a lower level, even if you train, even if you heard about it, which is one of the reasons why, you know, soldiers tend to perform better and better the more experience they get, as long as there's no, psychological, damage that happens to them in the process. Whereas police officers, typically after your, second or third use of force kind of thing, you're generally unemployed, right? Because you don't get to go back. So by the time you get really good at it, they'll find some reason, and not always, but oftentimes they'll find some reason to get you out of a job. Mm. And so the ones who would probably do the best may not ever have the opportunity to have the experience. And a quick example of that, when I worked at the stadium, there's this guy named Officer Jackson. I can't remember his first name, but we called him Saint Jackson because, I mean, you'd get, college kids puking on him. You get people throwing punches. I mean, it didn't matter what anybody did. And he was just nonplussed, just no reaction, didn't care. And I finally talked to him about it one time. We had a particularly bad situation and ended up with multiple arrests and whatnot. And for reference, when you're at a college football stadium, right, you try not to do paperwork. The worst thing you generally do is throw somebody out and take their ticket, right? You just don't want to have to deal with it because then you have to go to court afterwards and it's just a mess. And so the fact that you actually had formal arrests and all the paperwork just gives you a level of how bad it was, right? Fairly rare. And afterwards I was talking to him, I said, dude, like, how did you not get upset? This person, did all the, and he's like, well, I did two tours in Iraq. Like, he's not trying to shoot me. He's not trying to blow me up. What do I care? Yeah. And it was a great ref, right? I mean, I'm used to, if this is the continuum, right? I operate down here. He was operating up here. Mm. And so when it drops back down, it's like, oh, this is nothing. And it really gets to what you've experienced, right? If the worst thing you've ever experienced is, bad words mean a lot, right? And they have a real strong impact on you. If the worst you've experienced is someone trying to kill you, bad words, who cares, right? And it's just, it jumped the scale, but you get the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I worked with a guy when I was working in security as well, who similar thing, like the most calm, placid guy. Like I never saw him raise his voice. I never saw him break a sweat. I never saw him look worried. And when I started asking him about, I knew he'd served, but I didn't know what his background was. And his role was actually, his role was basically deconstructing IEDs and disarming IEDs. Oh. Right. And I said, man, okay, give you, it's a different level of calm. I mean, you can't do that in a panic. And I said to him, how did you manage the stress of that job? Like, I mean, the wrong wire, the wrong movement, or just reading it wrong, and it's gone. And he said, well, that's exactly it. He said, I just sort of focused on the fact that either I was going to get it right or it wasn't my problem anymore. Okay. I guess when you reach that level of, that's very Hagakure, isn't it? Meditation or inevitable death. It's a way to stay focused. Coming back to Sun Tzu, one thing I like to focus on in this podcast is the prevention of violence. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much Sun Tzu actually wrote on preventing warfare. It wasn't just about how to win wars. It was about how to win wars that never happened. And there's some amazing stuff. Absolutely. Yeah, there's some amazing stuff in there about posturing and relations. And what were some of your takeaways on that side of things?
Well, I mean, his big thing was, for example, if you don't invest in the military, it was like a crime against humanity sort of thing. Because if you're not the tough target, you will be a target. Now, remember, this is Warring States period, right? So maybe a little more violent times in the world than is today. But his whole thing was preemptive, right? You go to war when you're already won, right? You don't engage unless you've already won. And that's really the genius of his writing, is that it's all about anticipating and understanding the situation and maneuvering things. And it's really one of those, I'll give you another story. I'm trying not to do too many stories. So one of the things, Mark McYoung taught me this really cool trick of how to catch a punch. And normally when you catch somebody's punch, they realize, oh, I have just stepped in something and I'm going to stop now. And I did this a bunch of times at the stadium where somebody would throw a punch and I'd catch it. And frankly, it's actually kind of a parlor trick. It's not actually that hard once you know how. But it de-escalated immediately, right? Because even if someone's bigger, stronger, meaner, drunker, whatever, if you can do, you catch their fist out of the air and just kind of give them deadpan look, they tend to get the message and you don't have to continue fighting. It's really cool because they see this hard prepared target and it's scary. Well, that assumes people understand the violence dynamic. And what I've discovered is, especially the last few years I did it, as we grew up with the zero tolerance policies, people had never actually been in fights other than on video games. And they don't understand how to lose gracefully. And they don't even understand kind of the unwritten rule, right? And so you get some people who, you catch their punch and they don't get that visceral, oh crap. You get that, well, that was weird. Let me try the other hand. I especially found that with women.
Yeah.
Guys rarely would do that. Women almost all the time would do that. And it was very odd because I was really, I kind of stopped doing the security stuff around the time that pretty much everybody had a cell phone. And so I was starting to be really worried about things getting on video and how they look. And I was always very good at de-escalation. And I was in well over 300 violent altercations, and less than half of them actually physically got involved. The rest of the time I found ways to make it stop without actually, putting hands on anybody, either by, talking or by yelling, or in a few instances, I sort of cheated, like a guy threw a punch and I held up my clipboard and he smashed his hand into it and went, ow, and stopped. Right. So said a little more, a few other words than that, but you get the point. So, but what I found is, if you're a guy and a lady's attacking you, you're already in kind of trouble, just societally, that's generally a bad thing. Unless she's got a knife or a gun or something, in which case, then it's not so bad. I mean, it's bad for you, but like society doesn't look at it quite as bad. But what I found is, and I had multiple instances of this where a lady threw a punch, you catch the punch and the next one's coming and, then the feet and then the teeth and then, and it's like, there was no recognition. It's like, we're not playing the same game.
The ritual is not established. The violence ritual is not established. It's still novel.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a visceral thing that you feel it, but there's also this sort of deep psychology or whatever you want to call it, where like most people, even if they're left-handed, if they're really mad, they're going to throw a right punch to the face. Right. And there's a study, which if I knew I was going to quote that, I would have looked it up, but there's a study that shows that And the thing that behind it is that what you're mad at is represented by the person's face, right? That's the thing that's them. And it's kind of like when you see like bighorn sheep, right? If the sheep lock horns, they're not going to hurt each other. If one hits the other in the flank, they're probably going to kill it, right? So there's this sort of social violence type dynamic that gets to that kind of punch. And guys tend to do that kind of naturally and instinctively, and women tend to not. And I don't know if it's because historically this just wasn't a thing, or I don't know the reasoning behind it. But I found in multiple instances that it, the dynamic didn't play out like I thought it would. Well, it gets back to Sun Tzu and talking about, winning before you start, right? You have to set the thing up. And so what I started doing in cases like that is I would talk more than I did anything physically. And I would set it up and create witnesses so that, I know this, I know what's going to happen. I've had this happen before. I know where it's coming. And so I'm not talking to the person because they're too mad to pay attention. I'm talking to all the 78,000 witnesses out there so I don't get fired or thrown in jail or something when it does happen.
Absolutely.
And so, again, that's the whole strategic view of the world that you're learning from his things. It's really crafty, some of the stuff out there, right? But it's really trying to get to understanding your enemy and goading him or her into doing the thing that's going to be their undoing. And in some ways, I did that, in real life by playing to the audience so that I was protected for what I knew I was going to have to do. I wasn't worried about physically winning. I'm a black belt, and I've had, tons and tons of experience. I was more worried about the aftermath than it was the event itself. And so I was playing to the aftermath, which is, again, the strategy.
Yeah, that witness coaching is such a vital part of self-defense training that I think it's overlooked because most don't know how to do it. And if you haven't been through the whole violence process, and by process, I mean not just the pre-threat indicators and then the attack and then the defense and then the resolution, but then the court case and the payback and the aftermath and like all that stuff that happens like possibly for months or years after an incident. Unless you've been through that, sometimes you don't realize the value in setting the scene and coaching witnesses and being likable and having a clean social media presence and all that stuff that now, like you can get into a pub fight now and your Facebook will get you put in jail, right? So
easily.
That's going to be part
even
of
more so today.
And,
I mean, look at what happened in the nation's capital, right? In the US, right? Well, I mean, honestly, that read like a psyop to me personally. It's probably just a bunch of stupid people doing stupid stuff. But I mean, I do know people who like overthrew governments for a living for $3 agencies, and you rile up the stupid people and get them to do stupid stuff. They call me useful idiots for a reason. Well, the thing you see in there is the crowd dynamic, right? There's a dynamic with crowds when crowds turn into mobs, which turn into, into this almost its own beast, right? And people do stuff. And there's also a lot of reasons behind it, but people do stuff they wouldn't normally do and they get caught up in that contagion, so to speak. And, when you're involved with anything social media today, there's a whole bunch of people who are using that incident to say, oh, you made a post about thus and such, therefore you're like those people who are in the mob, whether you are or not. Therefore, you're going to get canceled, right? Which could be, you could lose your job, you could lose your career. I'll say our same thing, but you could lose your, you could get kicked out of your apartment or you could lose your relationships. I mean, all kinds of bad stuff can happen because you're now being dumped into this, oh, you're part of that crowd, right? So it's an othering thing there. There's a using it for power dynamic. And guess what? Sun Tzu wrote all about that kind of stuff. And how the modern thing is never let a good crisis go to waste. He never said it like that, but the whole thing is, right, how do you manipulate the events as they come up and turn it to your favor so that you're going to win? And you can see that with people, you know, thousands of people losing their Twitter or Facebook or whatever accounts and those kind of things, right? Because somebody has decided to take strategic advantage of a bunch of stupid people who went off and did stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to have on your social media that you might think like the stupid people, because then you get lumped in with them, right? I don't have Facebook or Twitter or any of that stuff. I don't find enough value in it to be worth the potential risk. And so I just don't do it.
Mm. It's quite interesting. I mean, here in Australia, most of our, and I don't want to deviate towards national security a whole lot because it's a different topic for a different day, but most of our national security attention is focused on China, being a major trade partner and also, you know, in our neighborhood. But it is fascinating that I think China's PSYOP and espionage is kind of at the top of the world. I mean, not many people do it. Not many countries do it better. And I don't think it's any coincidence that they've been studying Sun Tzu for several thousand years. So
I would hope so. He was Chinese. I mean, but, you know, but
well, you know, I was just recently been reading Musashi, the novel, right? And the number of references to the Art of War in that novel, and I mean, granted, it's a novel, it's a fictionalized version of Musashi's life. But we do know he was a student of the Art of War, and we do know that the Japanese nobility of the samurai era were all proponents of the Art of War, and it was already considered an ancient authoritative text then. So the fact right. that we're talking about something that's thousands of years later, and we're saying how applicable it is. I mean, they were still having that thought process 500 years ago, saying, "Wow, this old thing is really relevant." it's amazing.
Yep. Well, absolutely, and that's, you know, the reason that Chris and I wrote, you know, made the title "Shit Sun Tzu Said" was to make it stand out, right? Because there's like hundreds of versions of Art of War out there. And by the way, if you don't like having, speaking of the social media and all that, if you don't like having a book, it's called Shit Sun Tzu Said, there's another version of it. It's the exact same book that is Sun Tzu Said. It just doesn't have the shit on the cover because, you know, you got to have an option for people who want to be politically correct. But it is, I mean, it's really timeless, and you're absolutely right. You know, Musashi was using that. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, he, you know, the famous thing where the guy threw his scabbard down. I can't remember the guy's name who was going to duel. And he says, "Well, you're already dead because you've thrown your scabbard down, therefore you're not going to be able to resheath your sword," kind of thing. Or the one that they used in the Bruce Lee movie, Enter the Dragon, you know, where he's put him on the boat and let the boat go. You know, I mean, it's all about setting it up so that you can't lose. And obviously nothing is ever 100% can't lose, but if you are more strategic than the other guy, I mean, my favorite example of that, I had another thing in the stadium. I was in the East End bleachers, and they're so fairly steep. The stadium's been rebuilt since I worked there, but there was a fairly steep stairs going up to these bleachers, and there was a guy that was causing some problems, and it was very common there because you'd have kind of the home side and the visitor side, and then in the bleachers everything mixed, and those are the cheap seats too, so you combine those together, you had a lot of incidents there. So I, you know, get up to the top, and this guy is causing problems, and I call him out, and fortunately he came out onto the as the stairs go up, there's like a little almost like a landing area, whatever you want to call it, you know, kind of a wider, it's as wide as like six or seven stairs, and then it goes into more stairs again. So it's a little flat spot that you can go off into the aisles from. And so I got him over to there, and he's really drunk and really belligerent. And, you know, I start talking to him, and I realize he's going to throw down, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I goaded him a little bit. What I did is I just kind of grinned and leaned slightly forward. And as soon as he saw the body language, he immediately threw, right? So I sidestepped, and he literally threw himself down the stairs. And it was hysterical because it worked exactly like I thought it was going to, because, you know, he's on the edge of this little platform, and he throws a big old haymaker, again, right hand, you know, punch to my face. I just sidestep, and he goes down the stairs, crashes. He went down a couple flights of stairs, lands on the bottom. He's looking up at me, "Damn, you hit hard, dude." And all these people around that saw this are just cracking up laughing, right? Because I never touched him, but I got the result I needed, right? He knocked the fight out of himself by throwing himself downstairs. And that's the way, you know, I was thinking about it actually after that incident. That was probably at least 15, maybe even 20 years ago. And I'd actually read Art of War not long before that. I just finished it. And I was thinking, yeah, that's what Sun Tzu would have done.
Look, I really applaud you for writing the book, because I think The Art of War should be mandatory reading. If you're interested in this topic of how do we manage violence, how do we keep ourselves safe, how do we win fights or avoid fights, probably more to the, if you're a functional adult, how do you avoid being in fights? But or if you're in an occupation where you have to get into fights, at least how do we do it a little bit more strategically? We focus so much time on the tactics of and the actual mechanics of fighting, and we forget some of the strategy elements that are so crucial when you do have the time to be able to be strategic. And I think the Art of War is so powerful for that. But as I said at the beginning, it does rely on a little bit of experience to be able to figure out how to fit the gaps. And I think this book will be one that I recommend going forward for those that maybe don't have quite as much experience that want to see how it applies, because it does just spell it out really nicely. I do think it's something that all martial artists and all self-defense enthusiasts should read. Literally every modern strategy that you can pin down on any practitioner that you like, the origins you will find, and I'm not saying that they copied Sun Tzu, some of them probably haven't even read Sun Tzu, but you'll find a parallel. Everything from posturing and woofing, or the monkey dance, as Rory would call it, depending on what, you know, being big and an intimidating target. Sun Tzu talks about that. Being small and seeming defenseless until you're ready to strike. Sun Tzu talks about that. Misdirection, changing the topic, pattern interruptions. Sun Tzu talks about that. So whether you like Lee Morrison or Richard Dimitri or Jeff Thompson or Rory Miller or Mark McYoung or any other guru that you like, you'll probably find a lot of what they talk about, you will find parallels to in The Art of War. And again, not to say they've taken it, or but what works, works. And it's worked for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So I highly encourage you to make sure.
That's the critical thing, right? The tools have changed. In some ways, some of the techniques have changed, right? But the underpinning psychology and physiology aren't any different than they were back then. So, you know, back then they might've been using spears and, you know, bows and arrows. And today we're using, you know, rifles and nuclear missiles, but the underpinning concept, right, isn't really that different. And it applies at the macro level, you know, between armies, and it applies at the micro level amongst individuals. And you're absolutely right. All of those things, I was trying to not be real salesy, but yeah, what he said, I mean, that's why you need the book.
I'm going to sell your book. I invite you on the show. and I'm going to slap an affiliate link on it as well, just to make sure I get my 6 cents.
There you go. Well, you deserve it after that. I mean, that was quite the plug. Here, let's do the shameless. That's what it looks like.
I'll try to throw you honestly card over there.
Yeah, but it's a great book, and even if we hadn't done anything to it, Sun Tzu's work is great. We just made it relevant to modern folks and explained what does it mean, not going back and saying this happened in, you know, the year XYZ, but rather saying here's an example of this in modern times or in ancient times or in a business setting or in a personal self-defense setting, right? And draw it so that you can actually use it. And it's not just for self-defense. We use a whole bunch of different things because it makes it more interesting in my view. So
yeah. Absolutely.
But it's something that really, I think it gets to, you know, it allows people to do better in huge number of aspects of life. You want to go buy a new car and negotiate the deal? Read Sun Tzu. You want to defend yourself against some punk on the street? Read Sun Tzu. You want to, you know, get a good raise at work? Read Sun Tzu. I mean, it's really applicable to so much. It's almost unreal. Yeah. And the one thing that I'm actually kind of proud of is he repeated himself a lot. And there's some sections that it appears that there was either a translation issue or a chapter got repeated or something, because they're all kind of roughly the same length, and the one's like twice that long. And there's a whole bunch of redundancy department stuff in there, right? Yep. Where he says the same thing like 14 different ways. Well, we came up with 14 different interpretations or whatever the number was when he does that, so that you're not just reading the same thing going, yeah, I read that. Who cares, right? So we try to take it and say, even when he's being repetitive, let's come up with a different example, different use. And so it makes it more fun.
Yeah, and look, you and I both exist in the corporate world as well. You know, sometimes you need to say something 14 different ways for everyone in the room to understand it. So there's something that maybe it was done strategically for different people. But anyway, Lawrence,
I don't think so, to be honest. I mean, I actually thought about that, because it was like, is he trying to just hone this point? Or is there something? Because remember, the copy that everybody has today is mostly off of a 1917 or something like that, I forget the year, translation, right? Mm-hmm. So I think something happened in there. I suspect the original wasn't quite as redundant, but it doesn't matter. It's fun to read, and I think it's valuable anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Lawrence, we will draw close to the main interview there. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on the process behind the book and some of the key takeaways. As I said, I'll put a link to purchase the book in the show notes, so you can click on it and go straight through. Thank you. I was going to say, please thank you, Lawrence. Thank you, Lawrence, for your time. I've done too many interviews today. It's a public holiday here in Australia. I'm jamming interviews to try and get some in the can. So I think I'm just about out of caffeine. But thank you very much for your time. I know you're going to hang around and do the bonus questions with us in a minute, but for those that will leave us here, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed being on the show, and hopefully people find it useful.
Well, guys, I could have talked to Lawrence for a really long day. I could have spent half a day talking to Lawrence. What a great guy. Got a ton of information, ton of knowledge. He's written so many books. I'd love to do an episode with him just on how to write books, because it's certainly something I could use some help with. So, look, Lawrence was super generous with his time, and I hope you guys got a lot out of that. Make sure you pick up a copy of his book, Sun Tzu Said, or if you like the uncensored version, Shit Sun Tzu Said. I will put a link to those books in the show notes. So you click right through, head on over there. If you click the link, it goes through an affiliate link. I get a couple of cents for your purchase. It all goes in to help the show. So thank you very much. Guys, next week, I am changing gears completely. Next week, we are talking to Mr. Duncan Andrews from the UK. Duncan might be a bit under the radar, but he is a former riot police officer. He's a former Queen's Guard, a former soldier, high-risk riot prevention and infiltration. And he runs possibly the most detailed and comprehensive scenario training package anywhere in the world. So if you're interested in scenario training, how you go about doing it well, and what layers you may be missing in your current scenarios, and make sure you check out that episode with Duncan. That's coming up next week. But until then, I'll talk to you next time.